Chapter 6. David. I have turned on the television so loud it is nearly deafening. It is the only way I can hear. My neighbor Carl, the insurance guy on the left, not the cable technician on the right, has invested in a new circular saw. Everything is apparently much too long. He must cut his world to the proper length or terrible things will happen. His is a job that must always be done under the cover of early evening, preferably when others are trying to prepare lesson plans. Each day that I come home, I half expect to notice my neighbor's house is just a little shorter than the day before, until it is, eventually, only a roof sitting on top of a lawn, like a big shingled tent with an antenna on top and a big round saw inside, hungrily screeching and screaming for more. The television does nothing to muffle the metal whine, cutting through my thoughts with its jagged teeth every bit as well as it does through wood, metal, and plastic. But I know better. I know this is only what I have told myself, that the television is a pathetic attempt to drown out the saw. That is simply a lie. Inside, I know that the television is a pathetic attempt to drown out the silence that fills my home. Silence packed so deep it bows my windows and cracks the siding. Silence far louder and more emotionally disruptive than anything Black & Decker has to offer. I try to ignore the television and the circular saw and the silence. I focus again on the lesson plan in my lap, which is basically a blank sheet of paper in a brand new notebook filled with other blank sheets of paper. I used to have a laptop until the operating system seized up from the computer equivalent of a sexually transmitted disease. Thereafter, I had access to May's laptop. Now, May has her laptop all to herself. Far, far away. Paper is better anyway. On the table in front of me are 5 identical notebooks, one for each class. I don't believe in a generic lesson plan to cover different classes. Each class is unique. Quality teaching is adapted to the student. The teacher should go to the student, find the student, learn the student. A lesson plan should be well adapted, not one size fits all. This, at least, is what I told myself at the office supply store, staring at endless options of colorful, well-fronted paper products. I am predictably overcome by a secret fluttery giddiness at the beginning of each school year. It is the prospect of a clean page and a well-ordered life. It is the very idea of color-coding and alphabetizing and sharpened pencils with good erasers. There is an aphrodisiacal quality to back-to-school organization. Maybe not for everyone. But for me, there is a familiar surge. Not like sex, really, or dating. And yet it is a courtship of sorts. It is a flirtation between a man and an idealized conception of the future. It is an exercise in constructive anticipation, hopeful nervousness put to good use. It is knowing something is going to happen and preparing for that moment. Of course, there is preparation, and there is life. There is really no variety of back-to-school shopping that can adequately prepare a high school teacher for malignantly incurious students. Walking into a classroom armed with a lesson plan is on the same order of futility as using a whip and chair to motivate a colony of phytoplankton. The television attacks in a dizzying barrage of sound and color and swirling funhouse distortion. A man in plaid shouts at me about a Midnight Madness furniture sale. Sale, sale, sale! We're crazy! We're insane! We've gone mad! My thumb spasms, asserting itself, and the television implodes to blackness. I am relieved. I can actually feel waves of muscle tension receding. The circular saw takes another ripping pass through my living room, but even that is somehow more bearable than being drugged with synthetic electronic reality, as I am slowly crushed into paste beneath a juggernaut of infotainment consumerism. We live in the age of high-definition digital lobotomies. Nurse Ratched is now an international multimedia conglomerate. I search over my shoulder for the time. The wall clock is gone, and I know for the 100th time this week that May has taken it with her. It is hers. She brought it with her, and now she's taken it back. She has claimed time itself. I am wearing a watch, but that is hardly the point. It's only 7:20. I had hoped it was closer to 10 so I could justify going to bed. I resolve to go to bed anyway and make a move in that direction, which causes the phone to ring.
Hey, let's go to Billy Rock's.
It's Shep. I can tell he already has a buzz on. It's late, Shep.
It's 7:30.
It's a school night.
What are you, 12?
I'm working on my lesson plan, and I hate the music at Billy Rock's.
And?
And I don't have a car, and my entire family was just killed in a plane crash, and I have a nasty case of typhoid fever.
Meet you there in 20 minutes. Bring May along.
Okay. I hang up the phone and stare at it stupidly for a full 3 minutes. Shit. For 8:00 on a Monday night, Billy Rock's is crawling with people. I am surprised at this, and then surprised at being surprised. Billy Rock's is always crawling. I suppose what really surprises me is not that everyone is here, the parking lot is always full, but that this is where everyone wants to be. Everyone who is here is actually here on purpose. It would make more sense if these people had been yanked off the streets and plucked out of their homes and sucked out of the shopping malls and movie theaters by some malevolent force, Al-Qaeda or the Scientologists, and then imprisoned inside Billy Rock's as hostages. That would be just a little easier to swallow than the idea that people, human beings, come here of their own volition. That Billy Rock's beat out every other place that there is to be. I pay the cover and shoulder my way through an oily, smoke-laced clot of humanity just inside the front door. It's been at least a year since I've been to Billy Rock's, and I feel as though I have never left. This is the same depressing mob I had to shoulder my way through last time. The air is acrid and screaming with Electric Mayhem, the aptly named house band. Electric Mayhem has been its name for only about 5 years. The band wanted a clean break from a bad image, and so it changed its name. The bad image stemmed from an incident in which the bass player stupidly negotiated a crank sale with an undercover police officer, and then accidentally shot off his own hand in the ensuing melee. So much for playing the bass. Back in those heady days, the boys of Electric Mayhem went by the name Sonic Hurl. I'm an undiscerning neophyte when it comes to amplified retching. But the music, I say this in the loosest sense of that word, sounds about the same to me. The short hallway from the entrance empties into a large circular room that is writhing and pulsing with people, all of them on the make for someone or something. Billy Rock's has it all. Gay, straight, glam, punk, headbangers, leather and flesh, heels and boots, tattoos and ties. Tattoos everywhere. Small ones, big ones. Line drawings, multicolored glow-in-the-dark, ankles, shoulders, torsos, butterflies, hearts, skulls, flags. I thread my way between three women shouting and laughing at each other over their drinks. They choke off their conversation long enough to let me through, but re-erupt in laughter once I have passed. One of the women has eyebrows over-sewn with metal wire. The other has a ring through her lip. Tattoos and body metal. Everywhere. We are well on our way to Shrapnel Nation. 6 out of every 10 people I see has something obnoxious rammed through some part of the face. The third woman in the group looks clean and attractive, but the scary part is that piercing has become so common. Not yet mainstream, but so solidly ensconced in the suburbs of mainstream that I can no longer identify the women who have clitoral piercings simply by looking at them. It used to be easy, like spotting lesbians or Republicans. Social acceptance, however, leads headlong into seamless integration, and then deviance, old deviance, simply melts away. The men who have chosen to invest in scrotum bars are still a snap to pick out of a crowd, but I suspect that is changing too. To make matters worse, considerably worse, I feel shallow and judgmental for begrudging the acceptance of these skin-staining, body-piercing self-mutilators. I am a product of the tyranny of politically correct sensibilities. Drowning in the backwash of the civil rights movement and the sexual revolution. Judge not anyone or anything lest ye be branded a bigoted, small-minded asshole who is probably also a racist. My condemnatory faculties have been hobbled by my sense of self-loathing for having such an inhibited perspective that I cannot see the value or beauty in punching extra holes in my face and genitalia so that I might thread them with iron ornamentation. Who the hell am I to judge? My choices are the product of my upbringing, which is a product of my parents' socioeconomic and cultural strata, which they, in turn, inherited from their landed Caucasian forebears, and which is not something I should be arrogantly waving under the nose rings and nipple propellers of the commonsensically challenged. I so want to be the judgmental prick I fear I really am. For a good minute or two, I spin in place, turning and looking, turning and looking. Shep is, as far as I can tell, not here. Although there is a men's room and nooks and crannies of Billy Rocks that I cannot see. The room around me is, literally, cavernous. Mr. Rocks, Billy, if that really is what he is called, has done all he can to trade on his igneous namesake. The entire establishment is made to resemble a cave. Three stories of 21st century steel and concrete have been hollowed out into a single domed grotto. The walls and ceiling are 100% imitation granite, pitted and crenellated, with all the authenticity of the boulders hurled with disarming ease by salt monsters and hyperlibidinous Vulcans in early Star Trek episodes. A collection of those same boulders, albeit heavier and conveniently shaped as tables and chairs, juts out from the north wall of the cave to partly encircle a large sunken dance floor, illuminated from beneath by a mottled muddy blue light to resemble a subterranean pool. Thin forests of long, orange conical lights hang stalactitically from the upper reaches of the domed ceiling. At least a dozen of these lights are flashing like inverted electric highway safety cones. I cannot tell whether they are supposed to represent radioactive limestone deposits or long drips of oozing hot magma, but the color contrast with the murky blue of the dance pool is dramatic. Rising out of the east end of the mosh pit is a platform-studded multi-level stage where a lot of amplified screaming and spasmodic leaping takes place. One quarter of the circumference of the cave is lined by an enormous granite bar, glowing orange from inside as though the bartender stood in a pit of flame, which is just about how I would conceive of regular employment at Billy Rocks. The muscle-ripped man who takes my order, however, seems perfectly content. I silently assess that the likelihood of a scrotal ring on this guy is about an 8 on a scale of 10. He slides me a beer and an empty frosted glass on a bamboo coaster, which, I suppose, is to prevent me from making a mess of his bar, which is made of granite, so... The air around my head is so packed with jagged shrieking sounds that I send a telepathic apology to my neighbor with the melodious buzzsaw. Electric mayhem is gyrating its way through an astonishingly uncoordinated version of some song that sounds vaguely familiar. The lead singer's apparent effort to induce vomiting with a microphone inhibits my recall. Eventually, the lyrics in their guttural rasp bring it home. They sing about how the lunatic is in the grass and in the hall and in my head. The bassist begins pulling savagely on the strings with his teeth. They sing about my head exploding with dark foreboding. Perfect. I've heard it all now. Electric mayhem dismembering Pink Floyd. Why create something truly awful when you can desecrate something decent that already exists and punish the world with that instead? Half the work and twice as offensive. My beer is half gone and there's still no sign of Shep. Glowing orange blobs, made to look like jeweled amber, are scattered across the bar. There is one on every table and on every imitation shelf jutting out of the walls. They are easy to see in isolation through the dark, smoky cave, so much so that even one drink too many would lead someone to think he was hallucinating spots. I attempt to pick up the glowing reddish-orange blob in front of me, but it is firmly affixed to the bar. I put down my beer and use both hands to see just how firmly affixed. Mr. Muscle shakes his head in calm disapprobation as he empties two bottles of something over some fruit in a blender. "It really looks like amber," I shouted him by way of apology, as though my enthusiasm for aesthetic geology had, once again, overpowered my judgment. He stares at me over the scream of the blender, and I can see that he cares nothing for my explanation. Because bars have a way of turning me into a certifiable idiot, I follow up a bad apology with bad humor. "Should've called this place Billy Resins." I am the only one who laughs. The bar is a flurry of orders, singles and doubles and cliques of people who seem to swoop in sharply from somewhere behind me, shouting and pointing and laughing and staying only long enough to grab a glass or a bottle and slap a bill on the bar before bouncing back out into the fray. I am the only constant, the only bar hugger. I am self-conscious about what this says about me. I am different from others. I do not belong. Goddamn Shep. A woman leans in next to me. A girl. Woman. A womanly, girlish creature leans in next to me and winks at Mr. Muscle and his probably pierced scrotum. He mixes her a 7 and 7. She sucks on the ice cube as she waits for her change. "You making sure no one steals the bar?" It is the playfully derisive tone that I hate, but always manages to keep me off balance. "Yeah, wouldn't want this thing to wander off." "Waiting for someone?" "Yes and no." "Stood up?" "Looks that way." "Women," she says with mock disgust. She gives me a wicked look and cracks the cube between her teeth. She fishes another one out of her drink with two fingers and pops it in like candy. This is my first good look at her. She has the face of a 16-year-old girl and the barely clothed body of a woman straight out of the mind of a 14-year-old boy. Her hair is short and dark and matted to her skin with sweat. She has obviously been dancing. I know her legs are naked, but I resist the urge to look. "True enough, but I'm waiting for a guy." "Really? Say it ain't so, Joe." She pretends to look crushed. "Just friends, I promise." "Much better. Let's dance." She brushes my hand with her wet fingers. "Thanks, no. Gotta watch the bar?" "Not a dancer, believe me. It's for your own protection." "I'm Sam." She extends her hand, locking her elbow in an overly formal gesture. "Dave," I say, our palms flattening together. The contact is awkwardly prolonged and unnatural. The bartender stops by and gives Sam her money. He points at my beer with a question on his face. I shake my head and tell him I'm on the way out. "What? Leaving already?" she says. "Fuck your friend. Stay and make some new friends." She smiles and clasps my face between her hands. "And then fuck them, too." I can feel myself blushing. She lets go and I take a long pull on my beer. It is a transparently defensive gesture that only accentuates my lack of balance. I'm thinking of May. It's too soon. I'm not ready for this. But this is not about May. May is just an excuse. I am never ready for this. It is hardwired into my brain that getting laid is a daunting and complex proposition, something that requires sophisticated contingency planning, backup support, and shitloads of luck. And yet, when sex turns out to be a shockingly certain reality, the dissonance is paralyzing. I know this because more often than not, getting laid, at least as an adult, has never really been that difficult. Fairly certain prospects have presented themselves at regular intervals in my life, requiring me to simply assent. And, almost without fail, I find myself suspicious and distrusting of the opportunity, precisely because it is so damn easy. Sam does not wait for me to recover. Seriously, Dave, you could stand to lighten up a little. Look, I'm here with some girlfriends. The real party is going to start at my place in about an hour. Why don't you join us? You can leave all your inhibitions here to watch the bar.
No, really, I need to be going. School tomorrow. I should probably be getting back and getting home and going on back home because there's school tomorrow and it's getting late, so, you know, I should leave before I have, difficulty, you know, getting back before it's too late to go home. Before school. Tomorrow, really.
I have become Rain Man. I want to flee, screaming from the building, or at least start over with advanced warning. I have always been bad at this. I need lots of lead time, advanced preparation, cue cards, and mnemonics. I can play the sexual banter game all day long as I know it's not for real. But as soon as something is at stake...
School? You're still in school?
I'm a teacher.
Oh, good.
She leans into me, fingers on my leg, pressing her chest into mine and whispers, her lips brushing my left lobe. We wouldn't want to fuck a little boy.
No, we?
Yeah, like I said, me and my girlfriends.
Oh, well, no, probably not a good idea.
What?
Not into the whole group sex scene?
It takes a moment. A couple of silent beats as electric mayhem continues to scorch the air. Sam is smirking at me as the realization hits. I whip my head around and scan the room. I should have guessed this. And there he is. Shep is draped over a chair at a table near the wall. He is laughing so hard his back is hyperextended over the arm of the chair and he's clutching the edge of the table to keep from falling over. He couldn't possibly have heard our conversation. But he obviously didn't have to. My body language was loud enough.
Shep gave me $20 to do this, Dave, but if it's any comfort, I'd have done it for free.
Sam kisses me on the lips and lightly squeezes my crotch before she slips off into the crowd. My beer is empty. I know this. I take a swig of nothing anyway. I am angry and embarrassed. Two emotions that greedily exchange notes and encourage each other. I am so ready to storm out of this disgusting pit, this sorry excuse for a bar, this asylum for narcissistic, self-mutilating, sexually rapacious freaks. But I don't dare. I look at Shep laughing, and I don't fucking dare. I steel my nerves, leave the empty bottle on the bar, and thread my way through the throngs of dancing, screeching, laughing, sweating, glandular imps to Shep's table.
Very funny, I say.
I am as cool and nonplussed as I know how to be. Shep tries to pull it together in staccato fits and spurts. The girls with him, two on each side, are laughing too, although at least as much at Shep and his mirthful seizure as at me.
Dude!
More laughter. Hands over the eyes, head on the table, and then a Herculean effort to stop.
Dude, you have more restraint than I will ever have.
Obviously. I open my arms in a gesture that is meant to encompass Shep and his fawning entourage. I'm not sure there is anyone in the history of the world who has less restraint, Shep. Caligula comes to mind. Of course, Caligula was brutally assassinated by his own friends.
Oh, God, stop with the history already. Calm down. Just a little harmless fun. Have a seat. Tell us what you and your friend were talking about over there.
I think not. No way I'm sitting. How long have you been here?
I saw you come in. Took you long enough.
Thanks.
No problemo, dude. I've been dancing up a storm.
Shep leans back and rakes his fingers through his hair, pulling it out of his eyes.
Where's May?
Flu.
Oh, that's too bad. Like the barfing kind, or just...
Technicolor. There is an uncomfortable squirm from the ladies. When I left, she was trying to get it out of the carpet. Groans all around.
Whoa, Dave, TMI, we got the picture. Guess your evening took a serious turn for the better, huh? Honestly, Shep, it's a horse race. You're just pissed that Sam got those old juices flowing. This is good for a hearty squall of laughter from all five of them. I stand patiently and let it pass. Okay, enough of that, he says. I apologize. Sit and have a drink. I'm buying. Yeah, Mr. Johns, have a seat. It is the Mr. Johns and all of its discordant alien clunk that pulls me up short. The voice comes from the second woman on the left, the one nearest to me. She is patting the empty chair that is to be mine, but this is no woman. I stare at her stupidly. My brain scrambles on all fours up a hill of loose rocks for a better view of all I am supposed to know. This is a student. Third period, second row, in the back. Then it hits me. This is Ashley's friend. Ashley of the purple gum and the rolling eyes. Ashley of the Society to Protect the Historical Significance of Madonna. And yet, there is nothing about this creature that belongs in a high school history class. I am a teacher. I should be used to this. I should be hip to the state of the American teenager. Hell, I should be an authority on the subject. And yet the dissonance between my preconception of a high school sophomore and the vixen patting the chair before me is so profound that I am actually disoriented. Amid the confusion, my resolve to remain standing dissipates and I heed the instructions of her painted fingertips. I begin. I almost say Mozart. Brittany, third period. Unnecessarily, from all of 8 inches away, she waves at me with one of those hawkishly coquettish two-finger wiggles so popular among conniving playmates who make their living preying on stupid rich men. Brittany is a ways from pulling off the look, but she is disturbingly further along than she should be. Right, right, I didn't recognize you all. I am looking at her, searching vainly for words that are both accurate and inoffensive. The micro mini lycra or spandex or whatever it's called, the spaghetti halter, the pumps, all white. She is spilling conspicuously up and out of her halter. A white leather purse strap diagonally bisects her chest. It would be, I suppose, a cynically sexual ploy for an adult woman, the dirty virgin, the hooker bride goes clubbing. Except that this is not an adult woman. All tarted up, yeah, I know, she says, mercifully finishing my sentence. I almost never get carded. It's the hair and the tits. I'm way ahead of my time. I have not had an opportunity to fully take in the hair, but I take the cue. My God, the hair. It is big and tawny and ferocious to behold. It is hair that belongs less on a teenage girl than on an adult male lion. A taxidermied adult male lion. Brittany, I can't believe you! The mewling pretension of shock comes from the woman, girl, sitting next to Brittany, now covering her gaping mouth with her hand. I count 7 rings. And laughing in a raw, deep-throated conspiracy. The two other women, I think they are actual adult women, are talking with Shep, pointing to someone in the mass of undulating moshers. Relax, Carm, Brittany says to her friend. Mr. Johns is way cool. Ooh, I love this song. I could totally come to this song. Oh my God, Brittany! Suddenly she is on her feet, pulling me out of my chair, pulling her friend, Carm, out of her chair. Come on, let's dance! Brittany and Carm each grab a hand, and I am pulled along by the sheer force of their youthful, innocent, corrupted exuberance to the dance floor. Between the heels and the hair, Brittany is a full 3 inches taller than her teenaged alter ego. The three of us are swallowed whole, sucked in like chunks of flesh down the gullet of some ravenously indiscriminate beast. I am, against my better judgment, if not my will, doing something that I suppose will pass as dancing, although dancing at Billy Rock's is mostly a semi-rhythmic fight to stay upright and to keep swinging elbows out of your face. Brittany and Carm are
pogoing in place with their eyes closed and their arms swaying over their head, as though they're trying to surrender to someone from the other side of a tall fence. They moan and bite their lower lips, writhing in a highly contrived ecstasy to the sound of amplified indigestion. The beat is slow and churning with all the rhythmic sensuality of heavy road machinery popping granite boulders. It's obviously a signature song for Electric Mayhem, and they milk it for all it's worth. The lyrics are raw and unintelligible, although the word garbage must be of some thematic importance. Amadeus, it ain't. People are flooding into the pit from every corner of the bar. I bounce half-heartedly in place like a moron, pushed and jarred from every direction. The girls are facing each other, singing to each other. Something-something garbage, something-something garbage, so close their lips are almost touching. They take turns shimmying down into the blue pit by bending at the knees and wriggling toward the floor, as though attempting to lower themselves into elusive stools that are not actually there. I get that this is all for my benefit. I watch them as best I can while fighting for my life. Brittany begins rimming her parted lips with her tongue, and Carm follows suit. I am a man. I have taken erotic pleasure in degradations that are probably beneath my humanity. I have a laptop-sized paperweight to prove it. But either my humanity is more intact than I am generally inclined to presume, knowing myself and my gender as I do, or the tits and hair are far less convincing than these girls think they are. For I am watching children. There is not a bump or a grind or an orgasmic grimace that will convince me otherwise. Brittany and Carm grab each other's hips and begin stepping in circles, each simultaneously predator and prey. They both leer at me suggestively from the corners of their electric blue lids, licking their lips. They are horrendously bad shots, these girls. Having aimed for my lust, the proverbial broad-sided barn, they have struck instead at the heart of my revulsion for all manner of manipulative contrivance, especially of the sexual variety. Which is sickly ironic, since I am keenly aware that the force of this revulsion comes from being a complete pushover, a sucker for, as it turns out, all manner of manipulative contrivance, especially of the sexual variety. If history is any guide, I will buy just about anything and take personal responsibility for most suffering in the world, as long as the sales pitch is good. I am tragically predisposed to believe, to trust, to extend the benefit of every doubt until I am thoroughly screwed, time and again. I teach history. I do not learn from it. The music tempo steps up a notch, and the girls return to hopping up and down like 6-year-olds on a trampoline. They have not, unfortunately, abandoned the sneers and grimaces and snarls, the licking of lips and the flashing of teeth that they obviously intend as expressions of savage carnality, but which more closely resemble expressions of rabies or acute gastritis. Were my ego to drop its guard, I could admit that I am easily manipulated and that my guilt, my emotional sensitivity, and my desire are my sworn enemies. But I cannot admit this and still be the impenetrable, self-respecting, all-knowing, all-seeing man my father raised me to be. So, I tend to be an easy mark, an expert at rationalizing my mistakes, and a long devotee of the roll-with-it philosophy, which is itself a highly rationalized ethic for those who spend a lot of time getting rolled. So woe unto those few in the world, to wit Brittany and Carm, who are unable to pull off what is apparently so easy for just about everyone else. For it is the unsuccessful manipulator, it is the ham-handed contriver, who must carry the weight of my revulsion for all of those who have tried and succeeded. I turn abruptly to leave. Carm is too quick, grabbing my hand and simultaneously alerting Brittany to my intentions. They clasp hands around me and begin dancing in an unbroken circle. The garbage song intensifies into rapid explosions of screeching, and the floor turns from cool blue to a pulsating red. Around and around, a hellish version of Ring Around the Rosie. Finally, my impulse to intellectualize, to process, to understand, to quietly judge,
is subdued by my impulse to act. A forceful yank at the wrists, and I am free, abandoning them to each other and to the sacrificial demands of electric mayhem. I fight my way out of the pit and back toward the bar as my disgust hardens into anger. I know that this anger is at myself, mostly, but that will never do. I know that this moment calls for more than my normal self-flagellation, so I look for Shep. Shep, the irascible instigator. Shep, the shit. I search with an intensity that helps clear a path through dark and writhing knots of revelers. I do not hesitate to split conversations and spill drinks. People are parting like the Red Sea before Moses. I find Shep at the far end of the bar paying Mr. Muscle for 3 purplish drinks. She's a fucking student, Shep. She's underage. Just how badly do you want to get arrested and lose your job? Relax, Dave. I didn't bring them here. I didn't ask them to come. Shit, I don't even know them. Carmen is in one of my classes and I recognized her out on the floor. She introduced me to Brittany. I read them the riot act. They're drinking Cokes. They promised to leave by 10. They're just test driving their fake IDs. Pretty good, too. A lot better than I ever had. Shep, they don't belong here. This isn't a safe place for 16-year-old girls. Dave, I'm watching out for them. They're... Shep, the laid-back sex addict orgy meister, is watching over the children. Nice. They're fine, Dave. Everything's cool. Try to remember back when you were pulling the same shit. Remember, Dave? You're flirting with disaster, Shep. Even if you're looking after them tonight. Not true, by the way. You won't be here tomorrow night, or the next night, or the next. Well, yeah, I probably will. This isn't funny, Shep. You can't protect them. I'm not their parents. No, you're their teacher. Unless, Dave... Unless you get caught contributing to the delinquency of a minor, in which case you'll be the guy asking them if they want fries with their Happy Meals. Dave, I'm keeping them out of trouble. At fucking Billy Rocks? Dave! Look, Shep, I'm out of here. I strongly suggest that you confiscate the fake IDs and send the girls home. Me? Why am I the designated Nazi? You do it if you think you have to. You're in the same position I was in when I met them out on the dance floor. And speaking of dancing, dude, I saw the 3 of you out there. Don't start lecturing me about my duties. What are you going to do about it, Dave? I look back out at the mosh pit. Brittany and Carmen are gone. Fully digested. Great. I don't even know where they are anymore. Want to get him to turn on the house lights, conduct a search, seal off the... Fuck you. I'm going home. Dave! But he sees that the exasperated whine will have no effect. Whatever, dude. Give my best to May. I blow past Shep without looking back, pushing through thick clusters of people, more pouring into Billy Rocks every second, fighting my way upstream, down the hallway toward the door. At an adjoining hallway, the one that leads off to the restrooms, I am pulled by the wrist sharply through a wall of people. It's Brittany. Her face is flush from her recent exertion, and she is panting. She is saying something I cannot hear, and so I lean in. She kisses me on the lips before I can react. She is laughing in sly triumph and moving for the hallway. I wipe her sweat from my mouth, and she motions for me to follow her. I do, without really knowing why, to the end of the hall near a drinking fountain between 2 restroom doors, stalactites and stalagmites. The confusion is fully intended. All part of the gender-bending, age-twisting sex play at Billy Rocks, where you can expect the unexpected and meet new friends at every turn, even if you're sober. But I am too angry and now taken aback at my sudden abduction to put any more effort into the restroom identity conundrum. I have to show you something, she says. Brittany, look. Just wait. I have to show you something. She swings her small, woven white purse to the front of her body. The purse is attached to a strap that is looped around her neck. She unzips the purse and removes a smaller red bag, drawn closed by a drawstring, presumably intended for makeup. She opens the bag and holds it up under my face for inspection.
Brittany's makeup looks a lot like several joints tucked beneath a genuinely fake Ohio state driver's license. I am far from an authority on fake identification, but her photograph is crooked, and the plastic edges are frayed at the corner where she has inserted the razor blade. Her purpose is not to show me her identification.
Carm and I are going to smoke these out back in about 15 minutes. We've got one for you and one for Shep. You want to party with us?
She is a stupid, stupid girl, and this makes me all the angrier. Just who the fuck does she think I am? Does she think that I am really so desperately enthralled, so titillated, so bewitched by her feminine wiles, by her tits and her hair, that I will risk my career and my life outside of a jail cell to smoke some doobie in an alley for her approval? Is she so confident in the weakness of my character that she is comfortable exposing her drugs to her teacher? Neither of us is prepared for my reaction. No, Brittany, I do not want to party. How old are you? 16? 15? Look, I know the shit kids do because I did it too when I was a kid, but this is way over the line. You shouldn't be here. Neither should Carmen.
But Shep...
I don't care what Shep told you. He's lucky... never mind. Here's the deal. She turns angrily to leave. I grab her bare arm and jerk her back to the fountain.
Let go of me.
Not so fast. I'm not your parent, but I know you must have some parents somewhere, and I suspect that they would not be particularly pleased about any of this. So here's the deal. I release her arm and snatch the red pouch from her hand before she can stuff it back into her purse. I'm going to take the pot and the fake ID.
Hey, gimme!
I'm going to take the pot and the fake ID, and you and Carmen are going to go straight home. I want you both out of this place immediately. I've told the bartender to call the cops if he sees either of you, and if that happens, everything gets real messy. So you need to leave now. Your cover as an adult sex kitten is now blown. Time to leave. She is not looking at me. Her arms are tightly crossed and one hip is thrust dramatically toward the room where all the stalactites go to relieve their bladders. Is that all? She snips. No. Tomorrow, I want to see both of you in my classroom after school. I want to talk to you about fake IDs and pot and adult nightclubs. Just us. No cops, no parents. At least not yet. But trust me on this, Brittany. I pointed her right between the eyes. If I see either one of you in this place again, I will call the fucking Marines. Get it? She pushes past me, giving me the finger, stomping down the hallway back into the throngs where she is quickly lost. I follow close behind. But where Brittany turns left, I turn right, pushing past the bouncer, out into the parking lot. The door closes behind me, sealing electric mayhem like a scream inside a tomb. I pass a foursome of new leather-clad revelers headed for the bar. Another burst of amplified shrieking hits me from behind as they enter. And then it is gone again as the tomb is resealed. I am driving I-70 like a madman, pent-up rage I cannot control. 50 miles an hour, 60, 80. My old piece-of-shit four-cylinder Honda sounds like a distressed mosquito. I'm weaving around other cars, startling drivers. I'm now causing far greater risk of harm than anything likely to happen to teenagers inside Billy Rocks. I try to focus on Shep and the girls because that is why I am so incensed. Enraged. For the safety of my students, damn it. I'm responsible. But when my concentrated fury flags just long enough to avoid colliding with the side of a bus or slipping under the back of a semi, I find myself thinking of Sam. The sensation on my lips, on the little hairs inside my ear. We wouldn't want to fuck a little boy. I slam the gas and take it up to 85. The engine is going to pop. Fucking Brittany, little punk. Bitchy, spoiled little punk. Work in the nightclubs. Mozart. Oh, we love Mozart, do we? We're so mature and sophisticated. I fell for that one. What would Mozart think of something-something garbage? What would Mozart think of those ridiculous sexual antics, the whole oversexed Lolita thing? Well, I guess Mozart would have approved of that much.
Still, she'll end up dead before she's 18 if she's not careful. Mozart lived until he was 35, so I'm not sure what that proves. Forget Mozart. If she survives, she'll wish she had listened to me. She's back at Billy Rock's, commiserating with Carmen and Shep and God knows who else about the loss of her ID and her fucking pot. Mr. Johns, the once way cool teacher, now the asshole teacher. Mr. Johns, the Boy Scout who never tells a lie and never looks the other way. Mr. Johns, who fears all sexual opportunity like grim death.
Dave!
Prick. Had Brittany gone to Shep first with her offer, she would be having an entirely different evening right now. I pick the red pouch off the passenger seat and actually consider smoking her pot. That'd show her. That'd teach her about trusting strangers. Offer a stranger drugs and he's liable to steal it and use it all for himself. I stuff the bag into one of the cup holders between the seat, and for the first time, wonder what the hell I am going to do about Brittany and her pot. She's not getting it back, that's for damn sure. I could go straight to the police, but hysterical overreaction is likely to teach me more of a hard lesson than Brittany. I could go to the principal. No, same thing as going to the cops. He'd have to report it, and I'd come off looking like a sissy little shit, making a federal case over a fake ID and a couple of joints. Shep was at least right about that much. Pot and schemes to get into places I was too young to be was standard fare when I was 16. Fucking Shep. So what then? Her parents? I could do that. A sort of off-the-record, concerned word of caution. Mr. and Mrs., my name is... I'm your daughter's third period history. Have not alerted any authorities about this, but there's something you need to know about your daughter. The next time I will have to report, just wanted to apprise you. No, don't thank me. Just make sure your daughter is safe. No, really. You're very welcome. That would work. Except I told Brittany I wouldn't do that. Fuck Brittany. Little brat. Who cares what I told Brittany? I also told her that the bartender was poised to call the police. A fucking great lie, if you ask me. That's thinking on your feet for you. I'll meet with them. I'll inform them that it is my intention to meet with their parents, and they won't like that, and they will hate me, and their friends will hate me, and Shep will be the way cool fucking hero, and they can all just fuck off. I'm the adult. The exit to my neighborhood comes and goes. I drive aimlessly into the night. After 20 minutes, my anger has burned down to a pile of smoldering ash. I emerge from my furious reverie in the vicinity of my childhood home, the place my parents still live. Long-term muscle memory takes over, and I am steering without conscious thought. Exit. Left. Right. Left. Straight. And I am suddenly outside the house, where memory stops. I cut the engine and kill the lights and sit staring across the yard at the home of Hollis and Susan Johns. Warm, yellow light melts through the drapery pulled across the living room windows, spilling out like syrup onto the row of leaves piled up along the side of the house. My parents would still be up, doing their things in their own parts of the house. Mom on the phone or scanning cable news for late-breaking terrorist alerts. And Dad, sealed downstairs in his office with his wine and the music blaring. I'm here. I should go inside and say hello. But I don't have the energy. Mom will be all spun up about Tilly. For anyone else, the better room would have been my party room, or even Tilly's. That will lead to inquiry about what May is planning on cooking.
Decent view over the low-lying houses in the elementary school.
What May is not bringing
to the possibility
of
and why
out of a second-story window would have cost him all hope of privacy.
Not now.
If Ben...
I'll tell her at the party.
No, too inconsiderate.
Floor.
I'll tell her just before
I walk
the party,
as calmly as possible in the dark.
In time for her to my
cover
demeanor,
for her
assure
anyone who might
crisis.
Otherwise be inclined
but
to mistake
not enough
me
time
as a
for her to react to my lack,
which I suppose I am.
Crisis.
And a kidnapper.
Mom, May is not
I just
coming.
Happened to be related
she left
to
me.
The property owner.
She's not coming back.
And the
big question.
It's over.
I can tell as I run
seriously
that Ben's
well,
light is on.
Devastated, if you must know the
his
truth.
His shadow sweeps
so
back.
Anyway, I guess you're going to be short a pasta dish. See you at 6.
I reach the window and look inside. It's late. I should just go
home. My brother is in pajamas.
School tomorrow.
The one's covered with professional football
affiliate. We wouldn't want to fuck a little boy.
He is standing in the center of his room. His back to the window.
Work.
I should just
go home. His arms are in the air, swaying.
That thought is almost more depressing than
Billy Rocks or sitting
out here in
the car.
His midsection begins to move in slow, circular
motions. I close my eyes and let my head fall back.
But then he is back to swaying,
like a big palm in the breeze.
Deep sighs.
This is Ben's
suddenly
slow dance.
I know what it is I need.
I have seen him do that,
and I know why.
Time.
Without any conscious design,
mesmerizing,
I am here.
Deeply relaxing display of self-absorption.
Ben's bedroom is on the ground
floor. Sometimes he will do this when
a
song comes on the radio that, by Ben's standards, is irresistible. Usually a sappy oldie by Nat King Cole or Dean Martin or Roger Whittaker. Wherever he is at that moment, in the car, in an elevator, the grocery store, he will close his eyes, raise his arms, and sway until the song ends. He is always interruptible, and he will stop if you ask him to stop. But we try to leave him be. Once we had hardened ourselves to the stares and whispers of other people, our inclination was to leave him alone, to protect whatever unadulterated joy he is experiencing. The longer slow dance sessions like this one usually come with no music at all, at least none that we can hear. He has found a sound or a feeling that is strictly internal, a rhythm that is a slow, percussive riff from the beating of his own heart, and that is enough to move all 150 pounds of him in a kind of sinuous dance of worship that is impossible not to watch in wonder. Whatever moves him on these occasions floats upon the sea of silent mystery inside the head of Benjamin Johns. I lightly tap on the window. He's in too deep to hear. I try again, a little louder. He snaps to and turns around. It is too bright in his room for him to see out into the darkened yard. I tap again. He shuffles to the window and cups his hands against the glass. I smile and wave. Recognition and an expression of joyful surprise break like daylight over his face. Ben claps and waves and jogs in place, dancing from one big, bare, lily-white foot to the other as he fumbles with the window latch. As the window slides up, I reach in with one hand and quickly place a finger to his lips, doing the same to my own lips with my other hand. Ben freezes at this instruction, and I finish opening the window. "Hey, buddy," I whisper, "get your clothes on. We're going to a movie." Fantasia is showing at a multiplex 20 minutes away. On the off chance that my mother has looked in on Ben before going to bed, I have placed a note on his pillow explaining the disappearance of her younger son. She will be worried, and that will give in to anger at having to worry, and that will eventually make way for disappointment that I did not bother to come in to visit, but in the end, she will be glad for Ben's sake. We are late for the movie, but it doesn't matter. We've both seen it about a million times. Mickey is working magic with a broom when we step into the darkened, almost empty theater, loaded with enough popcorn and sugar-coated crap to sink a battleship. Ben is so happy he is vibrating in his seat. As I look at him pulling at a rope of licorice and staring in wide-eyed wonder at the screen, I marvel at just how rare have become true joy and the satisfaction of normal human expectations. It is these last moments of the day, the gratifying emotional substance they hold, that I had woken up wanting and, in all of my stupid optimism, expecting.